This is track 2 of lecture 8 in the series Inflation and Price Controls.
The deity needed for the planning of socialism would require intellectual powers even surpassing those I have described. For under socialism, any unanticipated event, such as a train wreck, an early snowstorm, a warehouse fire, an unexpectedly bad harvest, even unanticipated favorable events, such as the opposite of all of these, is a calamity, for it requires the replanning of the entire economic system. For example, if a train carrying a shipment of oil is destroyed, how is the socialist economy to decide where to take out the loss? It would have to look at all of the different possible uses for oil, all the possible remote consequences of its withdrawal from this or that area of production. And it would have to look at all of the alternative employments of factors of production that might be used to replace the lost oil, and all the permutations and combinations entailed in that, and then decide. By the same token, if as the result of good fortune, a socialist economy had fewer wrecks of tank trains than anticipated, it would have to replan the entire economic system to find the right use for the extra supply of oil. Capitalism, on the other hand, as we have seen in earlier lectures, responds easily and smoothly to unforeseen changes in economic conditions. Such changes simply bring about a change in the structure of prices and thus generate the most efficient response on the part of all concerned. Thus, the wreck of a tank train, to stay with that example, acts to raise the price of oil a little. The rise in price diminishes the consumption of oil in its marginal employments and simultaneously encourages its production, and of course, at the least possible expense to other productive activities. The reason capitalism responds so smoothly and efficiently is that every individual in the economic system is involved in planning the response. Each individual acts on the basis of his knowledge of his own personal or business context, and the actions of all individuals are harmoniously integrated through the price system. The essential problem of socialism is that it requires economic planning to take place without benefit of a division of intellectual labor. It requires that one man, the supreme director, or each of several men, the supreme board of directors, hold in his head and utilize the knowledge that can be held and utilized only by millions of separate individuals freely cooperating with one another on the basis of private ownership and the profit motive. The essential economic flaw of socialism is that in destroying private property and the profit motive, it destroys the intellectual division of labor that is indispensable to rational economic planning. As I say, therefore, the planning of the economic system as an indivisible whole by single individuals, let alone its continuous replanning in response to every unforeseen change, is simply impossible. Because the ruler of socialism, after all, is simply not an omniscient deity. As a result, although it is called central planning, socialism can never have anything even approaching a rationally integrated plan for the entire economic system. In reality, the actual planning of socialist countries is undertaken by separate government ministries, each responsible for different industries or regions. Even the individual factories undertake part of the planning process. The plans of these separate ministries and individual factories are only superficially integrated into an economy-wide plan. In this sense, the actual planning of socialism must be called decentralized planning. There is no alternative to decentralized planning, because it is simply impossible for any one individual to try to plan everything. Decentralized planning exists as soon as two or more people assume separate responsibilities in the planning process. But observe, Socialism does not have a price system. It does not because it destroys private property rights and the profit motive, the foundation and mainspring of the price system. As a result, the decentralized planning of socialism necessarily causes chaos. Because without a price system, the individual planners must operate at cross purposes. They must operate at cross purposes, first of all, because there is nothing to stop their various plans from presupposing the availability of the same factors of production. In such conditions, the execution of any plan necessarily absorbs factors of production, which makes the execution of other plans impossible. For example, if the shoe industry is planned by one ministry, the clothing industry by a second ministry, the steel industry by a third ministry, and so on, there is nothing to prevent all of these industries from drafting mutually contradictory plans. There is nothing to prevent them from basing their plans on the availability of the same labor or the same material or fuel, transport facilities, or whatever. In such a case, to whatever extent one industry succeeds in obtaining the factors of production necessary to execute its plan, it simultaneously wrecks the plans of other industries. Observe, because planning under socialism is necessarily decentralized, the production of each of the various goods can be expanded more or less randomly at the expense of destroying the production of other goods. This is the same chaos that prevails under universal price controls and universal shortages. Furthermore, to whatever extent individual industries or factories are given discretion in the plans, the products that are produced can very well be unsuited to the needs of other industries that depend on them, and in that way, wreck the plans of these other industries. For example, the plan for agriculture can be wrecked by the poor quality of tractors that break down, or which simply are not suited for the terrain. Observe, under socialism, suppliers do not have any incentive of profit and loss in meeting the requirements of their customers, nor are they subject to any form of competition. Each branch of industry under socialism is a protected legal monopoly that is totally disinterested in the requirements of its customers. This, too, is exactly the same situation we observed in the case of price controls and shortages back in Lecture 6. And it applies not only at the consumer level, but at the producer level as well. Under socialism, each industry, as well as each consumer, is at the mercy of disinterested monopoly suppliers. To understand what this is like, think back first to our discussion of the problems at service stations and in the relations between tenants and landlords resulting from price controls on gasoline and from rent controls. Now observe that similar or even worse problems exist around us in the present-day United States in practically every case in which the government is the supplier. For example, think of the services provided by municipal bus lines and subway systems, the public schools, the Motor Vehicle Bureau, and the post office. All of these operations are notorious in the utter indifference and contempt they display toward customers and in the low quality and lack of dependability of their services. These characteristics are the result of the fact that these operations are government-owned and therefore operate without the incentives of profit and loss. In addition, they are generally immune from the threat of competition. Because of this lack of profit and loss incentives, it doesn't matter to them whether they gain customers or lose customers, whether they perform fast and efficient service or slow and inadequate service. Now imagine the steel industry being owned by the government and run in the same way, and the customers of the steel industry having to contend with its performance. The industries needing steel would not be able to make their plans with very great confidence. Moreover, since they too would be owned by the government, they would not particularly care about not receiving the quality and service or even the kind of products they were supposed to. The effects on their customers in turn, and on the plans of their customers, would be compounded. For example, an industry waiting for a new factory, say, called for by its plan, would have to contend with the indifference and bad service of a construction industry suffering from the indifference and bad service of the steel industry. And so it would go with the plans of each industry wrecked by the lack of incentives and poor performance of every other industry further back in the chain of supply. To think of socialism as a planned economy is absurd. It is, in fact, an anarchy of production, a true anarchy of production. The fact that socialism is an anarchy of production could not be better illustrated than by the famous Russian quota system. Socialist planning in Russia assigns to each farm and factory a specified physical production goal called its quota. For example, so many bushels of wheat or so many pounds of nails. And each farm or factory is encouraged to exceed its quota. Now, this situation is essentially identical to the one we discussed under a system of universal price controls and universal shortages. For it means that there is a ready and waiting employment for more factors of production in every branch of production, with the result that any branch is capable of expanding at the expense of any other, more important branch. This, of course, is a system of pure chaos. The Russian quota system, moreover, illustrates the anarchy of socialist production in another major respect as well. The central planning authority does not even attempt to issue really precise production quotas because of the enormous additional detail that would be required. For example, at times, it has not even attempted to specify the number of each particular size nail or screw and so forth that is to be produced. It has simply ordered the production of so many pounds or mere units of nails or screws or whatever overall. As a result, depending on whether the orders were in terms of pounds or mere number of units, the factories concerned were led to try to concentrate on items that were giant-sized and enormously heavy, or pin-sized and very large in number. For these were the ways most easily to meet and exceed the quotas. The disastrous results for subsequent production can be imagined. Now, the quota system and its stress on meeting and exceeding quotas is an inevitable consequence of the fact that socialism cannot rationally plan. It results from the fact that a socialist government wants to expand production, but is unable to trace the connections among the various industries. It is unable to determine, and is not even aware that it is necessary to determine, the effects of producing more of any one item on the ability to produce other items. In effect, it sees the particular product it wants to produce in each case, but it has no concept of the cost of producing that product in terms of what other products it must forego. Socialism is unable to determine costs and is not concerned with costs. Please observe how much more profound this lack of concern with costs is in a socialist economy than in the case of isolated socialized enterprises operating in an economy that is based on private ownership of the means of production. Today, for example, the post office is not overly concerned with costs because there is no one in the post office who stands to make a profit by reducing costs or suffer a loss by allowing them to run up. In the context of a socialist economy, the problem of the post office or any other enterprise would be far more profound. In that case, it could not even know what its costs were because of the absence of a price system. It would be impossible for a socialist government to trace the connections between the operations of the post office and the rest of the economic system in terms of the alternative uses for the factors of production employed in the post office. Now, because this will be a matter very important for Lecture 9, please observe that socialism's lack of concern with costs produces exactly the same kind of labor shortage as exists under universal price controls. A labor shortage exists under socialism, both because of a socialist government's desire to produce more of everything, and because of its inefficiency and lack of concern with efficiency in how it produces anything in particular. The latter circumstance increases the amount of labor required to produce each good. In addition, of course, shortages of consumers' goods contribute to the labor shortage. I must say a few words specifically about the reasons for the existence of shortages of consumers' goods under socialism, especially since it is often claimed by socialist economists that such shortages could be avoided by a socialist society. Observe, widespread shortages of consumers' goods exist under socialism, even without inflation. They exist as a result of the following factors. First, the chaos in production and geographical distribution of the various goods. At any time, goods can cease being produced or cease being sent to particular localities. This can occur because particular plans are fulfilled that snatch away the necessary factors of production, or perhaps the very consumers' goods themselves, from other plans. Second, when this happens, the managers of the local stores and warehouses of the socialist society have no incentive and no authority to raise prices. Nor do they have the incentive or authority to try to anticipate such events and build up stockpiles. That would be speculation. In addition, all of the moral and political pressures of a socialist society work against prices being raised in any circumstances. A basic moral postulate of socialism is that goods should be free to whomever needs them. And if not free, then at least as inexpensive as possible. The political pressures of socialism are likewise overwhelmingly against price increases. The reasons are exactly the same as those which make rent control so popular in New York City. Namely, whoever succeeds in buying at the low price sees his benefit and applauds the government officials responsible. On the other hand, those who are victimized by the shortage the too low price creates rarely see any connection between the too low price and their inability to obtain the good they want. They view the low price as being in their interest too, and hope to be able to buy at that price. So all of these circumstances alone must create widespread shortages, which of course are worsened by the desire to hoard that necessarily accompanies them. On top of all this, the socialist government can issue additional money to the consumers and probably does so. Now, before I conclude my discussion of the economics of socialism, there are some further points I would like to make. The most fundamental fact about socialism is that government ownership of the means of production constitutes an attempt to make intelligence and initiative in production a monopoly of the state. Observe, production depends on the possession of means of production. If the means of production are monopolized by the state, because it arbitrarily claims to own them all, then no one is free to produce on his own initiative and to regard his own intelligence and judgment as the ultimate authority for his action. In a socialist economy, no one can produce without the permission, indeed, without the orders of the state. This attempted monopoly of intelligence and initiative is the cause of socialism's anarchy of production. Socialism simply prohibits all of the independent planning of millions of free, self-interested individuals that is required to run an economic system in a rational, ordered way. There are additional corollary consequences of socialism's monopoly character that should be stressed. Namely, the necessary technological backwardness of socialism and the utter powerlessness of the plain citizen under socialism. To understand these points, compare the conditions of socialism with those of capitalism. Under capitalism, whoever sees a profitable opportunity for action is free to act on his own initiative. He is powerfully motivated to do so by the prospect of the profit he can make. At the same time, he is restrained from rash action by the risk of losing his own money. In addition, his action constitutes a threat to the established order of doing things. For if what he is doing is in fact an improvement over present products or present methods of production, then those producing the present products or practicing the present methods must copy his or be driven out of business. Competition exists, too, in the fact that if an innovator lacks capital of his own, he can turn to any one of hundreds or even thousands of independent sources of financing. Thus, under capitalism, he has hundreds or even thousands of chances to obtain backing for his idea, while all he needs is success in just one of those chances. And, of course, his potential backers have powerful incentives, for they will share in the profits or losses. Thus, it is not necessary under capitalism for an innovator to convince everyone, a majority, or even a significant-sized minority of people of the value of his idea. All he has to do is convince any one person or a handful of persons who possess the necessary capital to give his idea a chance. Because of its freedom of initiative, its incentives to use that initiative, and its freedom of competition, the products and methods of production of capitalism tend to be literally the very best that anyone in the entire society can think of, and to improve further as soon as anyone can think of any still better idea. But of course, we saw all of this back in Lecture 3. Under socialism, on the other hand, individual initiative is paralyzed by the fear of punishment. Prison replaces profit for the man who would seek to implement an idea of his on his own initiative. If an individual does manage to think of some improvement under socialism, he must submit it to the government, whose officials, of course, have no economic incentives to adopt it. The only way it can be implemented is by the government's order. And the government will determine what his reward, if any, is to be. If it does not approve of the idea, that is the end of it. Under such circumstances, very few new ideas are thought of, fewer still are implemented, and virtually none at all are of benefit to the plain citizen. Please observe the complete and utter powerlessness of the plain citizen under socialism. Under socialism, the plain citizen is no longer the customer who is always right, but the serf who must take his rations and like it. No official in a socialist government stands to make a profit by supplying him better or suffer a loss by supplying him worse. These officials both lack the incentive of profit and loss and need not fear any competition from the initiative of outsiders. As I have said, everything applies to them that applies to private businessmen under price controls and shortages. It is not even necessary to speak of the absence of any improvements for the plain citizen. Even if it had the ability, socialism has no reason to supply the plain citizen even with such goods as already exist and to which he has already grown accustomed in the preceding era of capitalism. Indeed, it has no reason to supply him with anything more than is necessary to prevent an uprising. Consider a simple example. Assume there is a neighborhood somewhere that needs a grocery store. Under capitalism, this need represents a profitable opportunity for someone. Whoever sees it and has no better opportunity available simply opens a grocery and proceeds to make money, at the same time satisfying the need. Under socialism, on the other hand, the residents of the neighborhood can only obtain a grocery by petitioning the Economic Planning Board for one. Even if the residents actually went so far, which is itself highly doubtful, The officials of the board would have no compelling reason to comply with their request. They would certainly be far less likely to do so than officials presently accede to requests for traffic lights at dangerous intersections. And that is often only after repeated deaths have occurred. Thus, we see again the phenomenon of consumers reduced to the helplessness of mere pleading that falls on deaf, indifferent, and often hostile ears. The simple fact is that under socialism, the consumers must accept whatever the government decides to give them. The paralysis of initiative and incentives under socialism knows no limit. It extends to death itself. For example, if one asks how it is that Russia can periodically be threatened by famine, despite the fact that it possesses the world's richest farmland in the Ukraine, and was a major wheat exporter even under the czars, the answer is that the individual Russians are prevented by physical force from taking the actions necessary to save their lives. Russian peasants, however ignorant they may be, are not so ignorant that they do not know that to eat they must grow food, nor do they lack the knowledge to grow sufficient food. They could grow not only enough to feed themselves, but the urban population of Russia as well, and far more. The urban population of Russia could produce things of value to the peasants, and they could mutually exchange and both live far removed from the threat of starvation. Why don't they? The answer is quite simple. The Russian government has arbitrarily declared the whole of Russia to be its property and refuses to allow the peasants to farm for their own profit or the urban population to produce for its own profit. It threatens, quite literally, to kill anyone who tries to do so. Thus, a Russian peasant may look at virgin forest land that he could clear and make his farm, and which would feed himself and 10 others. He may look, but he will not lift a finger because he would be killed for trying. People starve to death under socialism because the actions they would have to take to prevent starvation would bring them a more immediate death from the government. It is that simple. The government of a socialist country is not and has no reason to be interested in anyone's values but those of its rulers. This follows from the fact that it does not make a profit by serving the citizens, nor suffer a loss by not serving them, nor does it have to worry about competition. This principle applies both to technological developments and to the whole of production. The only kind of technological developments that a socialist government is interested in are those which are of value to its rulers. Above all, improvements in weapons production and in the kinds of things that add to the ruler's prestige, such as Sputniks or pyramids. Of course, even these, or their base, it must steal from capitalist countries, because it is impossible significantly to develop military technology or any other aspects of technology of special interest to the state while repressing civilian technology. For example, the tank and the military airplane could not have been developed in the absence of the automobile. Radar and rocketry could not have been developed in the absence of radio, and so on. But the automobile and radio would never have been introduced under socialism. The only kind of production a socialist government is interested in is the production of weapons, spectacles, and monuments, and of just enough consumers' goods to prevent a revolt or mass starvation, either of which would weaken its power. Ironically, in Das Kapital, Karl Marx refers to capitalists as, quote, blood-sucking, quote, vampire-like, quote, exploiters. It is clear, however, that it is not capitalists, but the rulers of socialism who are the genuine, blood-sucking, vampire-like exploiters of labor. Minimum physical subsistence is the most they will ever voluntarily give to the masses. Over 50 years of communism in Russia confirm this principle. But in the long run, they cannot do even that. For as should be apparent, as a result of its anarchy of production, Socialism cannot even maintain its slaves in their slavery. In quotes, the workers of socialism, quote, sink deeper and deeper into poverty, unquote, to borrow some other of Marx's choice cliches and apply them truthfully for once. If anyone doubts that the standard of living under socialism tends to sink below the level of minimum physical subsistence, let him consider where the Russians would be right now without American wheat, given to them at the expense of the American taxpayer, for nothing or on credit that they will never repay. Let him consider how many Russians would die from the famines that would then result. Well, this essentially completes my survey of the economics of socialism and why it must fail. In lecture 9, I will explain how socialism destroys individual freedom and creates a totalitarian state. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're ready, we can begin the question period. Could I repeat some of the things that happen under price control, some of the elements of chaos, and which I rhetorically asked, would they happen if businessmen were free to pursue the profit motive? One was, would businessmen sell their goods too cheaply and create shortages? Would they abandon the production of vital goods if they were allowed to charge profitable prices? Would they run up the costs of production if those costs came out of profits? Would they drive away customers offering them profitable business? Would they flood some markets and starve others? Would they produce some products to excess while not producing enough of others? Would they overinvest in some industries and underinvest in others? They would not do any of those things if the price system were free to operate. Dr. Binswanger, let me ask if there are any written questions coming also. Dr. Binswanger?
Are you going to discuss in future lectures any of the attempts of socialists to get around the problem of the economic crisis by planning?
All right, I have a question. Am I going to discuss the attempts of the socialists to answer this criticism? Well, I think now would be a good time. All right. All right, I won't go into that specific variant, but let me give a general statement about how the socialists attempt to deal with this. By dealing with it now, we'll have more room next week for some other matters, or the next lecture. The critique of socialism that I have given you is essentially a development and elaboration of a critique first put forward by von Mises in 1920, I believe, in an article, and then developed further by him in his great classic, Socialism, which I recommend wholeheartedly to everyone. Now, Mises pointed out that a socialist economy had to lack economic calculation, therefore it could not plan. The socialists did not know what to make of this. Most of them are still ignorant of this question. The overwhelming majority of socialists know nothing about economics. But the handful that do have some familiarity with economics took the attitude, well, Mises is right in claiming that economic calculation is important. And it was, we must admit, a rather careless oversight for all socialists for the previous 100 years to be advocating a system that would have to destroy civilization. Sorry for the mistake. But the dialectical forces of history have led Mises to point this problem out, and He's called it to the attention of the socialists, and now they recognize the problem, and before they destroy the world, they can come up with a system of socialist calculation. I am not exaggerating. You can find practically these very words in the writings of Oscar Lange in a book called On the Economic Theory of Socialism. Oscar Lange taught at the University of California, left that university to become deputy premier of Poland. Now, he is considered the major critic of Mises, and what he has proposed has come to be known as, quote, market socialism. Sometimes it is called liberal socialism. The system, which I will describe in a moment, was put up for consideration in Russia by an economist named Lieberman under Khrushchev. It has not been heard from since, and we'll see why with good reason. Now let us consider what market socialism is supposed to be. It is an attempt, allegedly, to graft a capitalistic price system onto the body of socialism. You can think of it as the equivalent of the mythical beast of Greek mythology that was half man, half horse. Now, in arranging market socialism, it is claimed the socialist economy will be broken up into different sections. Each of them will be allotted a balance at the government's central bank. The government will assign prices to all of the different goods and services. It will then tell the managers in charge of the different sections or enterprises, go ahead and make believe you are capitalists. Produce on the basis of what is profitable. Now, this is called the, quote, parametric function of profits. Lange, Lieberman, etc., claim that in a socialist economy, profits could be made to serve a, quote, parametric function. What that means, in very fancy language, is profits will allegedly serve as a guide to what to do. The different managers will act as though they're capitalists and do what is profitable, but of course, no one will actually profit from doing what he is supposed to do. Now, the question can be raised, if the individual managers are going ahead acting on the basis of the prices of the socialist economy, well, these are arbitrary prices, of what relevance are they? Well, Lange and the others have an answer. They claim the state will adjust the arbitrary prices it sets to the point of balancing demand and supply. Lange claims the state could begin, and these are his words, by drawing prices at random from an urn, calling them out randomly, and then if the demand is excessive, the state will raise the prices. If the demand is deficient, it will lower the prices. And by a process of trial and error, arrive at the right prices. Now, on this basis, it's claimed that socialism can have a price system. Therefore, it'll have all of the advantages of capitalism, plus more, because the government will now pocket all of the profits instead of the capitalists. Well, I must say that the belief that socialism could have a price system has gained the preponderance in the profession of economics. Most university students are taught from textbooks and by professors who claim that this is an actual viable system, market socialism, and in courses on comparative economic systems, they present market socialism as though it's a real economic system, and of course they hide the real nature of true socialism that actually exists, and they create tremendous confusion. They present a good case for socialism by making it appear functional, and because it's supposed to be of a market character, they create the impression that it's compatible with civil liberties and political freedom. To grasp what is really wrong with market socialism, this is such a far-out, unreal idea that the major critical point is to make the actualization of the idea real. The only way to make market socialism real is to start with an existing capitalist economy. So we've got capitalism now, and let us observe two fundamental alterations in capitalism, alternatively, and we'll see what their effects are. First, let's simply imagine that the government adopts price controls. Then we'll forget about that assumption, we'll go back to capitalism, and we'll imagine that the government adopts just one other measure, namely the right to confiscate everybody's property anytime it wants to. We'll trace out the implications of these two alternative changes, then we'll put them together, then we'll know what to think of market socialism. All right, let's start with an existing capitalist system and the government imposes price controls. Now, Lange, Lieberman, and the others tell us the government can find the right prices through a system of trial and error. Okay, well, if we have de jure capitalism, the private owners certainly have an interest in the government adjusting prices. Well, now let us ask, why hasn't the government ever set rent controls properly or the price controls on gasoline? Why weren't they adjusted so as to equalize demand and supply? Well, the answer is the government officials, A, have no self-interest in setting the right prices, B, the moral and political pressures are on them to keep prices artificially low, as I described in our discussion of shortages. And C, in the absence of freedom of competition, there would not even be any way for the government to know what is the right price. Take the gasoline shortage. Suppose the government had called in the oil companies and said, well, you tell us what price control to set. Would all of the oil companies have had the same idea? Some oil companies would have wanted a price control higher than other oil companies. Which should the government have listened to? The only way that we could learn the right price is through the freedom of competition and the price being set on the basis of self-interest operating in an environment of freedom of competition. Well, obviously, market socialism, if the only change that were made were price controls, if the government is controlling prices, the prices it sets are not going to be the same prices as set in the market. All right, let's put that aspect aside now. Let's assume that the only power the government assumes is the power to confiscate everybody's property anytime it wishes. Now let's concretize what that would be like. That would mean that next year or 6 months from now, the government could take away the capital of General Motors, give it to Ford, or give it to Teddy Kennedy, or Ted Kennedy's mistress, or whomever. Now, it could do the same thing with the real estate of Manhattan Island, or the farmland of New Jersey. Now, let us just consider what effect, and the reason I'm stressing this case is, here we have existing owners. If the government assumed the right to take everybody's property, the government could say, we allow the present owners to stay on. They are our officials. We're telling the present owners, you boys just go ahead and act as you've always acted. Act for the most profit. Only, of course, the profits belong to us, the state. Well, obviously, if they knew that they could be expropriated anytime the government chose, that would have a very major effect on how they acted. They would not do the same kinds of things they now do. Their self-interest, what would now be profitable, would be to consume as much of their wealth as possible or conceal as much as possible. Now, what this state of affairs would be like if we had the government able to snatch away everyone's property anytime it chose, that would be comparable to the economic conditions existing in Europe at the time of the Viking raids. There would be no security of property. That is how property would be treated. Now, market socialism expects that this insecurity of property would not matter. It expects that all of the people who are running the properties will act in just the same way as the capitalists. They'll very nicely wait to be expropriated. Now, what this whole nonsense of the parametric function of profits boils down to is, you're supposed to do something that is profitable. Never mind to whom it is profitable, whether it is profitable to you or to your expropriator, you do the same thing. Well, now, that is just impossible. What would be needed to make that type of arrangement work is not the omniscient deity that we talked about before. To make socialism work of this kind, where you have alleged private owners, I shouldn't say private owners, you have separate individuals with genuine powers of discretion, and the government can wipe them out at any time, what would be required to make that system operate the way capitalism operates is that you would need the saints of altruism to come down and do the exact same things as businessmen. You would need Jesus of Nazareth, Francis of Assisi. They would have to come down and make believe that they're Rockefeller, Carnegie, etc., acting for the greatest profit, and meekly wait, turn the other cheek as they're expropriated. Then the next set of managers will dutifully act to do what is most profitable and wait till they're expropriated. Now, suppose we had that system and no price controls. The government said, we assign parcels of property, we give full discretion to particular individuals, only we own the property. Now, if the government did that, they might have an economic system as viable as, say, the economic system of Turkey in early modern times or Persia, because this very system existed in many parts of Asia. In many parts of Asia, all land was owned by the sovereign and held by his subjects at the pleasure of the sovereign. Because there was no security of property, the state of economic conditions in those countries was barbaric. No one would improve the land or develop a factory because at any time it could be seized from him. Now, if you have that system and then you add in the price controls, well, you have simple total chaos. That is what market socialism would actually be like in practice. Now, this whole proposal is in fact dishonest because the advocates of market socialism are very inconsistent in their advocacy of it. None of them, in fact, has the courage of his convictions and advocates total discretion. They still want the government to tell the individual managers what industries they'll be operating in, what factories they will have at their disposal, what equipment, where those factories will be located, and what products they're to produce. The only kind of discretion they want to allow, really, is the discretion to achieve the goals set for them by the socialist government with the means assigned. That's a very narrow, insignificant range of discretion. We are back to the problems of original socialism in asking, how will the government decide how many factories and machines to assign to each industry? How will they decide what products are to be produced where? All of that has to be decided outside the price system. Then the limited range of discretion that they're willing to allow would simply cause further disruption and interfere with whatever limited priority planning they are able to achieve. For example, a socialist government, if it drops context and concentrates on a few isolated items, can say, all right, we will produce so many tanks or planes, and we don't care about the rest of the economy. This is all we're aiming at. Well, if you had this so-called limited market socialism, you'd have it would be impossible even to accomplish such priority planning, because who knows, at their own discretion, the individual managers might have snatched up some spare parts or some basic material required for tank production. So I think for this reason, the proposal has never been implemented to my knowledge, and if implemented, would quickly be abandoned. So that is what I have to say about market socialism. Socialism is really at a dead end. In resorting to market socialism, any socialist who knows anything about economics has implicitly conceded the superiority of capitalism, and one must say that intellectually, socialism is now dead. Any further questions? Dr. Buechner? All right, now you say, if you have a system of parametric function of profits, wouldn't it be possible to give rewards to the managers? And then to carry it further, you would have to say, why not, after they'd built up some rewards, take away some of what they had gained and let them have losses? But now, if you do this, you are then really introducing some private ownership. If the state were to say, we make an assignment of the funds of the society to different individuals, we tell them, invest profitably. You will be able to keep part of any profits you earn. Then we will let you decide how to invest these profits. If you have losses, you will lose part of what you've earned. Then they would, in fact, be getting back to capitalism. But then they would have the problem, would this be recognized property rights, or would they take the attitude that after someone had earned something, they could expropriate him at any time? See, if they build in long-term property rights, then they are, in fact, back to capitalism. Otherwise, they're back to the Asiatic system of Turkey, Persia, etc., where the state can take away anyone's property at any time. So there is, in fact, no real solution, except, as Mises saw over half a century ago, the establishment of capitalism. Yes? All right, you ask, what about the computer solution to the centrally planned economy? Well, a religious person would raise the question, I don't mean to make it you, but I mean they. If they were religious, they could say, what about God? Because when you say, what about a computer? Well, what would you have to put into the computer? First, you would have to put in the exact quantities, locations, technological possibilities of everything. You would not be able to assemble the information. And now suppose you somehow could get all this into the computer. What does the computer give you back out? What could the computer tell you? It could simply tell you an incredible, assuming there was such a computer, the computer could tell you, okay, if we start off with these 20 million inputs, we get these 20 million outputs. Now, what does that mean? A computer is of no help in that kind of situation. Yes? How would I define fascism? Well, I think I would define fascism essentially as Nazism. I would say it's that variant of socialism which seeks to maintain the outward guise and appearance of private ownership of the means of production. Now, fascism, of course, differed from Nazism. Fascism in Italy differed from Nazism in Germany in some important details. For example, the fascists were not anti-Semitic as the Nazis were. The fascists did not go quite as far in their plans as the Nazis, but the idea is essentially the same. Now, the reason for the popularity of the use of the term fascism is because the communists like to use fascism rather than Nazism, since Nazism has a reference to socialism, and they don't like for their enemies to be known as the same thing as themselves. Mr. Kirkpatrick? Do I have any statistics from World War II days about nominal GNP versus real GNP? Not off the top of my head, but they're very easy to get. You could look them up in the income and output statistics of the United States, published by the Department of Commerce. It's a volume issued in 1958. Any business library would have it. The real output of the United States during World War II, if you're including the tanks and the artillery shells and the aircraft and so on, considered that way, the output was significant. But the standard of living was very low because all of the effort that would have been going into making houses, automobiles, etc., was going into the production of tanks and planes and going into it very inefficiently. And the effort that was left for the civilian economy was very inefficiently applied because of price controls. So what you would want to ask is, the way to look at it, if you went back and you looked at the statistics for nominal gross national product or nominal national income, and then subtracted government spending, so that what you were left with was actual private consumer spending. Then deflated that for the inflation. Then made some kind of allowance for the lack of availability of all of the goods that I've enumerated and the deterioration of quality, then you'd have some kind of realistic measure. But what is usually done is the statisticians take the GNP, or the sum of incomes, they're very close concepts, and they conveniently ignore the fact that something like half of people's incomes was piling up in government bonds or other forms of unspendable savings, and they weren't deriving any benefit from this major part of their income. Yet they were counting this as though it represented real wealth. Yes, sir, Mr. Mangero? All right, you say you don't see what I mean by saying that socialism is intellectually dead, because you do not see it losing its appeal. Well, in one sense, I have to agree with you. We're headed, as of now, for socialism. But I would say that, nevertheless, it is intellectually dead. And I would give evidence, first of all, from right here in the United States. Ask yourself how many people today regard socialism as a genuinely idealistic system any longer. How many of them look forward to socialism as being able to establish a new era for mankind? I would say that no one today, or hardly anyone, holds socialism as an intellectual ideal. And I would say that the manifest failure of socialism in country after country is one of the major factors responsible for the sudden mushrooming of mysticism. For decades, people have thought that socialism represents the implementation of a rational program. Now they see the failure of socialism, and they take that as a failure of reason. Just as one concrete instance, look at some of the people who were in the Chicago Seven. At least one of them has now ended up as a follower of the Maharaji. In Soviet Russia, I was recently reading a book of essays called From Under the Rubble, which was originally published in Samizdat, which is the self-publishing in Russia. People type illegal manuscripts, and they pass them from hand to hand, and each person who gets it retypes it and passes it on. Well, there was one essay by a man named Igor Shevarovic, who I believe is a member of the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And he was making the point that the Russian people have now thrown up a kind of scab over communism, that it can no longer reach them, that everyone goes through the motions, everyone at all of the meetings has to go through the ritual, say the words, but that in Russia itself, communism is, as an intellectual ideal, is dead. And in fact, in this same book, in one of the essays of Solzhenitsyn, I share all of Ms. Rand's criticisms of Solzhenitsyn that she made in Boston, but nevertheless, as he has some interesting observations on Russia, he makes the point that, I believe it was him, rather than Shevarovic, that after Khrushchev's disclosures about Stalin, the Russian army, in an effort to secure recruits, had to appeal to Russian nationalism rather than communist ideology. Now, if you have to appeal to Russian nationalism rather than communist ideology, well, I couldn't imagine that being a stronger sign of death. Because what intellectual appeal can Russian nationalism have? See, communist ideology at least was a great vision, however ultimately absurd, however absurd upon serious analysis. But if you look back, say, in the late 19th century, when people didn't know better, they thought, many of them, that socialism could achieve a worldwide harmony of interests among all people, that it would build a just, prosperous society, would solve the leading problems of mankind. I don't think anyone believes that any longer. As a matter of fact, I was planning to save this for Lecture 9. I would say that now, the bare handful of advocates of capitalism that there are now, for the first time since the 1830s, more sincere advocates of capitalism than of socialism. Now, there may be only 50 or 100 of us, but there are fewer still of them. Dr. Binswanger? Yes, as Dr. Binswanger says, and as I've been saying, the socialists no longer advocate socialism as a grandiose system. They're getting down to what he describes as their basics of simple envy. And you can see the intellectual level of socialism has collapsed. Socialism is not seriously advocated. It's advocated now in folk songs, not in treatises. And when a movement reaches that level, then it's intellectually dead. Yes? What would I describe as the economic system of the so-called... What is the economic system of most of the so-called emerging nations, which are not really emerging, but submerging? I would say feudalism. It's the same economic system they've always had for millennia. And even socialism in those countries is no change. Now, as a matter of fact, it's an important point to keep in mind that when socialism takes over an agricultural country, the system remains essentially as it has been. It's simply a continuation of the existing feudal structure, but the local satraps are changed. They now are appointed by a different central government. Yes? Yeah, they do nationalize whatever foreign investments they have, and that isn't incompatible with their essentially feudal character. You see, even Russia itself, I would say, is still predominantly a feudal country, or very largely a feudal country. By their own statistics, 40% of their population live in the rural areas. For all we know, maybe it's 60 or 70%, and they live under essentially the same conditions as feudalism. But I don't want to say more about that now because I'll have something to say next time. This gentleman back here.
Could you comment on the use of input-output analysis and the so-called solution to the problem of centralized
economics? Would I comment on the use of so-called input-output analysis as a solution to the problems of economic planning? Now, input-output analysis was developed by a Russian-born economist at Harvard named Leontief. It's interesting why he resides here. This system is supposed to be, as the questioner indicates, a solution to the problems of planning. Now, as far as I know, all that this system does is it observes that so much steel goes to each of the different steel-using industries, so much of the output of the different steel-using industries goes to other industries, and maybe comes back to the steel industry. Now, if you were to attempt to break this down in the kind of detail that would be necessary, and not just talk about broad aggregates based on monetary terms, but if you were to get it down to the nuts and bolts, you'd be back to the problem I mentioned of having to grasp all of the factors of production in the entire economy, what they are capable of doing, and when, and then projecting that forward. So to really talk about input-output in a way that would be useful, The socialist government would have to know each and every product of the steel industry coming from each and every mill, as of when, and going to each and every individual customer, and then what they would do with it, and so on. And that is too big a problem to hold. Yes? Well, that's interesting to know. Mr. Samara? Is GNP a fallacious measure of wealth or production? I would say essentially so. It is a fallacious measure. What gross national product or any monetary aggregate essentially is based on is the quantity of money. The reason the GNP is now 1,500 billion instead of 500 billion is because we have a sufficiently large quantity of money. We could make the GNP double or triple as soon as we increase the quantity of money sufficiently. The idea that money measures the goods is a fallacy. Yes, sir? How did they both gear up to such a large production of war materials? Well, the United States swamped Nazi Germany in the production of war materials, and the reason that we were able to swamp them is that we had had a free economy for much longer and to a much fuller extent than they had had. And we did not have planning as long as they did. Now, as a matter of fact, I recall reading after World War II that Goering, who was their top planner, made statements blaming their loss of the war to a large extent on the fact that they had such a highly controlled economy with very great inefficiencies in production. I mean, just think, if you have a war and the most unexpected, terrible changes are going on, you then need the fastest possible, most efficient response. To have price controls in a war is extra devastating, or in any emergency. Take a simple example. Suppose you have a bridge bombed out or flooded out, and you have to get supplies into the locality. Well, if you allow the prices in the locality to jump, then people make the special extra effort, and the supplies immediately come in. Like to think in terms of our own context, suppose there's a bridge knocked out across the Mississippi and a little town is cut off from milk supplies. Well, if the officials who ran the town would only allow the price to jump, people would start bringing milk in on rafts or whatever. They'd find a way to do it and the supplies would not be cut off for very long. But instead, they insist on having a control and they perpetuate the problem until they're able to get the bridge fixed. Any further questions? Mr. Kirkpatrick? Yes, I would say that the price controls that we had in World War II hampered the war effort. Because let's observe how an economy would operate without price controls. Imagine we suddenly get involved in a war, and it's necessary to have the most rapid possible conversion from peacetime production to wartime production. Well, in an economy that maintained a price system, but we'll assume it had taxes would be increased. The consumers would have less to spend on all the various consumers' goods. Their production would immediately become less profitable. The government would have correspondingly more to spend on all of the war goods. Their production would be more profitable. Businesses would immediately convert facilities as rapidly as possible, and they do it in each case in the most efficient way. So we would have the most efficient response to an emergency situation. Mr. Schwartz? All right, you say, would I comment on the argument that as long as there are free elections, the government must still be responsive to the will of the people. I would say that that is a totally fallacious argument, because elections are suitable only for deciding certain broad philosophic issues, not matters of detail. Now, take this problem of the grocery store or the traffic light. People cannot obtain the new traffic light precisely because you cannot make a traffic light at an intersection an issue in an election. What kind of election? Should you say, Mayor Beam is for the traffic light at Corona Boulevard and his opponent is against it? Now, you cannot have such an issue featuring in an election, even at a local level. Now, could you allow each local neighborhood to vote itself the traffic lights, the grocery stores, etc.? Well, if each neighborhood had such authority, who's paying for it? The rest of the economy. You can't grant such authority to the areas that are small enough to be affected. Now, I would say we can observe right now, without waiting for socialism, the loss of the power of the voters, simply because we still have free elections. But what good does it do to have a free election if the federal government is the only government that has power? For example, take the case of something like the Forest Hills housing project, let's say, or the issue of school busing. Now, the people in the local areas, like in the Forest Hills housing project, the local people were very much against the Forest Hills housing project. Why couldn't they have their way? Because that issue was no longer a local issue, it was a federal issue. How do you decide a federal election on a local issue? You can't. Well, in a socialist economy, the only meaningful election that they might have, and not even that, as we'll see next week, because there's no free press in a socialist society for reasons that we'll discuss, no free speech, but assume somehow you could maintain a free national election. Well, that means once every 4 years or whatever, you would vote for the supreme dictator, and then he and his deputies would be telling you what to have for breakfast and what you could read, and now try to change that in an election. The only way for the average person or the plain citizen, I don't mean just the average person, anyone, not part of the elite, to have any power over his own life is through his ability to spend his own income and to make others respond to his spending. If you take that power away, you make the individual powerless. Are there any further questions? Okay, well, it's been a very enjoyable session for me. See you all in 2 weeks.